Romina, Colin, Tim, serious HT right there. Hat tip. For those that don't do the Twitter abbreviations. Some people say don't try this at home. That I would only try that at home. I would never try something like that from on stage. Wow. That was serious. Thank you. Well, good morning. My name's Cor. For those, many of you do not know me, and that is quite all right. At Hope, we have a lot of people come and go. Statistics tell us that somewhere between a third to a half of you are new in the last year or two. And so if you are in that place where you're newer to Hope and you don't know me, that is okay. My name's Cor. This is my family. That's my wife, Jill, and my two boys, Drew and Isaac. We've been at Hope for a number of years, almost since the beginning, when I was a student at the University of Minnesota, trying to figure out what to do with my life. And Hope showed up at a really opportune time and just grew me up as a leader. And I love and appreciate the vision of Hope, which is to honor God by helping as many people as possible become fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. So to break that down very briefly here, honor God. It is about God and not about you and me. It is about God and not about Hope Community. It's about God and not about all of our church plans. We exist to glorify, bring Him honor, worship Him, because He is the best. He is the greatest. He is worthy of praise. He's worthy of your attention and affection every day, day in and day out. There's no one like Him in heaven or on earth. He has no equal and no rival. So we're here to honor God by helping as many people as possible. Now with that, we want to help people. There is a quantitative aspect to Hope's vision. We want to help people. It's not just so we can be a little group, cloistered off from the rest of the world. No, we believe that Jesus is worthy of praise and honor, and so we want to spread that message to as many people as possible. Not just so that we can say, hey, this is how many people come to our church. That's not what it's about. Rather, we want to see His name influence many, many, many people in this city, in this state, in this nation, around the world. But in doing that, we're not just looking strictly for conversions, one-time prayers, one-time commitments, but rather, we want to help them become fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. If you are walking with Christ, He wants every area of your life. He wants your mental thinking. He wants the heart, the affections of your heart. He wants the habits of your day, the behaviors of your life. He wants you whether you're going to work or coming home from work. He wants you whether it's a Sunday or a Monday. He wants all of you. And so we talk about making fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. That's what we're about here. And so if you're new to Hope, that's what fires us up. And so, if you're checking us out, new to Christianity, that's what marks us as a group, as a church, as a family. And one of the things I also appreciate about Hope is Steve and the leaders here try to take robust, big, cosmic ideas about who God is, theological dogma and doctrine and massive heavenly things, and make them understandable. So that I, as a 18-year-old new believer, could take and eat and digest and try to understand. And you're going to get a little bit of both of that today. We're going to get some of the big, heavy, lofty, and yet hopefully by the end of this, we boil it down to a couple easy, digestible concepts and understandings. Ways we've done this in the past, just a couple examples of way we've tried to do this in the past. Like for example, one part of 2 Corinthians, it talks about what God does in our hearts. And in talking about that, he compares God's work in our hearts to bring the light of who God is in there by comparing it to Genesis. When God says, let there be light, that brought forth this amazing physical creation. It's unbelievable. And God does that in our hearts spiritually, where he says, let there be light. And all of a sudden, where there was darkness and death and brokenness and sin and pain, God says, let there be lights in our hearts. And I compared that one time to a chemistry shower where my wife had pulled the shower chain and all this water just filled her classroom. And there was this whoosh, whoosh, whoosh that came from that became a like an instant meme of Hope or something here where it was spread like gangrene. And so that's a way that we take this crazy big idea and we try to make it just understandable. Another way that we might do this is worship. It's kind of crazy, right? We're this finite little 6 foot, some of you 5 foot, some of you 4 foot something, little being, right? And we're going to come before Almighty God and worship Him through song. Like this is absurd. This is craziness that we would worship this this God from you know, the Alpha and Omega, the beginning, from thousands, just infinity, going past, he's there, and then going into the future, infinity, just, he's there, and he sees everything, he knows everything, every atom, every molecule, he's orchestrating. It's just crazy. And then we come before him. And so ways that I might help you to understand this, we'll just give you some, maybe some postures during worship. You could try some of these here. This is some of you guys out there, you like the elbow flap. That's the way you worship God. That's how you do that. Some of you lift a TV. You know this, right? Some of you do this. That's okay. Right? Some of you lift a bigger TV, right? You get it into your neighbor's space next to you, right? Some of you, this just isn't charismatic enough, so you take it up a notch. You talk about how wide your fish was, how big your fish was. That's probably a trichler. Or the hold my baby. New moms out there, hold your baby. Or Mufasa, right? Just lift it up to God. The next level is probably, it's stretching my comfort zone. I've never actually heard of this one on the left here. Dueling light bulbs. Do some of you do? Some of you do this? I guess I should look around more to see if there's people out there doing this. Goalposts to heartburn? Is that? I don't know that I've been in church long enough to see all these, or I'm just in the wrong church here. Is that, people do that? And I'm used to this. I like the solitary. I think it's simple. I think it's dignified. I think I can handle it. It doesn't feel too crazy. I did it in school. I do it when I want Steve's attention, you know, my boss. I feel like that's where I want to go. Some of you do the fist, do the finger. That's okay. That's, as long as the right finger. And then this next one says expert. I don't think it's expert. I just think it's like, how comfortable are you, right? How comfortable are you within your space? Because some of you go big. Some of you go, you have no problem. It's like you want to just like touch the glory, you know? Pull it down, pull it in, the Rocky, the touchdown. So it's a big, amazing concept that we try to make a little bit more understandable there. Now you're all going to be self-conscious during communion and worship. So we explain things as we make you uncomfortable. I really appreciate this from Timothy Hawkins, especially the warning that comes at the end of all these. He says, violent horizontal movement and the waving of oversized flags are strictly prohibited, will result in immediate ejection. You think the people in orange shirts are just to try and cram you in? They're actually to remove you should you get a little too excessive in your worship. But I share these things because today in Esther chapter 3, we're going to need this. There are some big, heavy things. There's some things that are hard to understand about Esther chapter 3 that by the end of our time together, we got to boil down to a little bit more easily digestible concept. It's hard. When you're reading through the Old Testament, and you're just going through the stories, God's story, Israel's story. There's times where I just am dumbfounded by what I read. And then Steve says, hey, we're going to preach on this from up front. So today feels like one of those days. We're in the middle of a series on the book of Esther, which is in your Old Testament. And it's during a time and a period where the temple is no more until Israel, as the people of God, are dispersed amongst kind of the known world at that time. And there's a lot of confusion about how do I live without the temple? How do I live when we don't have this religious order where it's very clear what is to take place in my religious life and my observance of God and the following of the law? What do I do? And so we are in that period where it's hard. There's confusion as to what the people of God should look like. So let me just quickly update you. If you haven't been a part of our study yet, we're in Esther chapter 3, but what has taken place so far? There's a king, King Xerxes, fifth king of the Persian Empire. So we're in the 400s, the 5th century BC. And in chapter 1, he throws this massive party. Okay? His dad tried to take over Greece. It didn't happen. And so there's still a desire when it comes to Xerxes to capture Greece. But he calls all his officials to this massive six-month party to get all of them unified. They can all see what a great guy he is. There's lots of drink happening there. And then at the end of that party, he calls for his wife to be paraded in front of all of his guests. She says no, and he says, all right, well, then you're banished. You cannot come into my presence anymore. And then what follows this is a 5th century episode of The Bachelor, where he sends some officials away, and they're going to get all of these women that are going to get brought before him, and he will or will not extend a rose to them, and they will... So then we introduce Esther. She's one of the women who receives beauty treatments over the course of a year. She receives these, and then she is brought before the king. And it's really hard in these first couple chapters to, like, where's the good guy? Where's the good girl? Who are we supposed to be cheering for? Whose side are we on? Are we on the side of Mordecai, who is Esther's relative, who kind of put her out here, or not? Are we supposed to get behind Esther as the one who's going to go forward in this manner? Or should she have resisted? What do we think about Vashti or Xerxes? Or one commentator said this: the biblical author makes no attempt to vindicate Esther and Mordecai by explaining the extenuating circumstances or reporting that they had divine counsel to behave as they did. It's confusing to know who are we cheering for? Who's the hero of this story? And if you've been in that place of just kind of leaving and just kind of like, gosh, I'm not excited about any of that, you're in good company. But after the parading happens, we see the king. Indeed, there it is. He's extending his scepter or rose there, a 5th century BC rose there to Esther. She becomes queen. At the end of chapter 2, they uncover a plot. Mordecai, the relative of Esther, uncovers a plot. And that's how chapter 2 ends. I don't know why this is a very confusing, but as I looked it up on Google, that was the image that they gave me. So now we're in chapter 3 here. And I want to read it, and then I want to make some comments. And then we'll try to understand some of the bigger concepts that Esther 3 brings out here. So let's read together. It says, after these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, new character, Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to him, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, why do you disobey the king's command? Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated. Remember, how did he treat Vashti? For he had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, the Pur, that is the lot, was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, there is a certain people dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all the other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them. I will gather 10,000 talents of silver, the king's administrators, for the royal treasury. So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do with the people as you please. Then, on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children. On a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they would be ready for that day. The couriers went out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. That's our text. That's our story for this morning that we want to now walk through, make some points about, highlight some things, and then hopefully by the end of our time, come forward with a couple takeaways, seeing this in the light of God, who He is, and the good news of Christ and what He has done. And so let's go back through this a little bit slowly, kind of verse by verse, making some comments along the way. So after these events, what just preceded this was, remember, Mordecai uncovers a plot that was going to take King Xerxes' life, and nothing happens to him. No recognition. That will come later on, but immediately no recognition. That's rare, okay? Some other time has passed. We don't know how long. Commentators disagree. Years, question mark, could be up to 5 years have taken place. So after these events, King Xerxes honors Haman. New character. We don't know who he is. We don't even know why when it says that they've elevated him, given him a seat of honor higher than other nobles. We don't know why. The text is silent on that. So we have this person who's been elevated, and we as the reader are just unaware. It stands in stark contrast, though, because after chapter 2, you think, well, Mordecai, he's going to get honored. He just uncovered a plot that was going to kill Xerxes. He should get honored. He's not. And so there's just great story happening here. But the one clue from this verse that we need to unpack a little bit more is he's an Agagite, which if you're new to the Bible, I'm not expecting you to know what that is, what that means. I want to very quickly, in a couple stories, show where does that come from and why does the author include that point? Here's Haman. He's an Agagite. Why is that important? So backing up about 500 to 600 years to the time of King Saul, first king of Israel, United Kingdom. We got to go back to, let's see, he's installed in what, like 1051 BC. Okay, so we're going back from the 400s to 1051 in the time of Saul. We read from 1 Samuel 15 these words. Samuel said to Saul, I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to the message from the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up out of Egypt. Now go attack the Amalekites and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. That's hard to understand coming from Samuel, who's speaking for the Lord. That's a hard teaching. That's hard for our ears to hear that God would put this forth, because we're gonna come against Haman making a similar declaration. This is hard stuff, but God is judging the Amalekites with divine retribution through a people, through his people fighting the Amalekites. Hard to understand. I get that. Let's keep tracing where these Amalekites come from. Let's Just finish this story here. Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur. Near the eastern border of Egypt, he took, here it is, Agag, king of Amalekites, alive. And all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag. That's like one of those words, you know. You ever do this with your own name? You're like, core. But you'd be saying your name, but you're like, that doesn't sound right. Core. I've been saying Agag the whole week, and I've said it probably like 30 different ways, and it's just weird. It's a weird name. But anyways, Agag and the best of the sheep and the cattle, the fat calves and lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely. Yet, what was God's edict? Wipe it all out. So they disobeyed, right? Everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel. I regret that I have made Saul king because he has turned away from me, has not carried out my instructions. My instructions were to take care of the Amalekites, wipe them out. He doesn't do that. Agag is the king, and they take him alive, and they're not supposed to. So there's that connection. He's an Agagite. Comes from the Amalekites. Where do the Amalekites come from? Some of you who don't like some of this stuff, it's okay. I'll catch you up here. Once you see a porridge bowl of some lentils, you'll know to come back. All right? So second story here. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites. So now we're going back to Exodus, time of Moses in the Exodus. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites of Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. You remember this? Remember this story where he goes on the mountain and holds up his arms and then he gets tired? And so they prop up his arms in worship. You got to go back to the expert, you know, village people, touchdown. Somehow he's got to get his hands up in worship. And when his hands are up, they're winning the battle. When they're not, they're not. And so they prop them up. They come alongside and prop up his arms within this battle here. And it says, the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered. And make sure that Joshua hears it. Because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and called, the Lord is my banner. He said, because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. So God is against the Amalekites. That this isn't just Saul and Israel kind of attacking, but this has been a generational thing between the Lord and the Amalekites. Where does Amalek come from? Amalek is the grandson of Esau. Okay, so we have Jacob and Esau now. Esau is a character. Sorry, if you are just checking out, you just knew the Bible. These are a lot of names. You don't have to remember any of them. You have to remember all the people's names that you're sitting by, but not the ones from the Bible. So Jacob and Esau, the story there is Esau sells his birthright, gives up his blessing. Takes multiple wives. Doesn't follow the instruction of the Lord. And so we see, tracing this back, that there is a generational thing that happens here that we can see at the headwaters of Jacob and Esau. And so it's not just like the Israel's fighting a completely other, different. It's like, no, this is happening within the family. That there's connections here and there's a purifying that God is trying to do amongst his own people. You might have lots of questions. That's what third service is for tonight, 7 p.m. You can come back and ask. Okay, but that's where we get it. Esau, grandson Amalek, who comes later. Agag is the king of the Amalekites. And then all of a sudden we come to our story where Haman is an Agagite, a part of this whole lineage. I think I caught that bunny there. All right, back to our story. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. So we're amongst the king's court, an area right outside the king's hangout spot. Okay, there's this court of officials doing what officials do. They officiate stuff and they make decisions and they go forth and they bring peace and they make sure stuff is happening as it should be. Mordecai's amongst that group of people. He's hanging out with them, but he would not kneel down or pay him honor. A little bit of silence textually here about why won't he pay him honor. The only clue we have will come later in verse 4 where it says, well, he was a Jew. We don't know for sure. With some measure of conjecture, we're, we're wondering, we're asking ourselves the question, is Mordecai acting like Daniel and his buddies? Remember the story of Daniel? He wouldn't eat the food. No, I'm not going to eat your food. And he's like, and then, you know, this is a problem, Daniel. You got to eat the food, because if you're not eating the food, and then all of a sudden you don't look so good, and then you don't perform so well. And Daniel's like, no, test me. In 10 days, I'll eat my stuff that I can before the Lord, stuff that's consistent with my observance of God and who he is. And then all these others that don't, they can eat your food. And then just look at us in 10 days. Test us. Daniel comes out looking good, so everything's okay. Then there's this whole fiery furnace bit where it's like, no, you got to worship and bow down. And they're like, no, we're not going to do that. Even if it means that you're going to throw us into this fiery furnace, we'll go. We're willing. Our God is able to save us. He will save us. And even if he doesn't, the former part is still true. He's able to save us. And so they get cast in the fiery furnace. Is that what Mordecai is doing? It's just hard, right? It's just hard to know Mordecai's, what he's doing, what he's thinking, because we have split decisions about him. Sometimes it seems like he's doing great things. Other times he's putting Esther out there to marry a pagan king, saying you should just go along with this, even though we might look at it and go, gosh, that violates a lot of what God's telling them to do and how they're supposed to act. And so it's hard. It's just hard to know Mordecai, his desires, what he's trying to do, what he's withholding from and joining in on. Let's keep reading here. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, why do you disobey the king's command? Day after day, they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. So these officials, they're hanging out in this gated area, and they see him, and it happens again and again, over and over, and he won't bow down, and he won't give him, Haman, the attention that is due him. Therefore, it says, they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told him he was a Jew. There's our only contextual clue. He told him he was a Jew. I'm not going to do this. Why? I'm a Jew. I'm not going to bow down to that guy. I won't do it. I'm not going to dishonor God, and I'm not going to honor Haman. So he seems to pick and choose different areas where he is going to act consistent with what the Lord might have for him. Other times it's a little bit shadier, and we don't understand why he'd put Esther out there. And then it says this. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Having learned who Mordecai's people were. Now we go from at the individual level, Haman, Mordecai, to now we're talking about people groups, families, nations. When he learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. Now this one layer of disrespect for Haman is saying, no, I don't want just Mordecai dead. I want all of them dead. Anybody that might disrespect me in this way, may fail to honor me, not give me homage, I want them all dead. And so you and I might be leading a Sunday school class or leading our kids through the Bible, we might be thinking, all right, how do I discuss genocide with my 5-year-old? How do I do that? If I'm taking people through the book of Esther, and let's say, for example, I want to do it with, I don't know, some vegetables. How do I explain to kids genocide with a tomato and a cucumber? You don't have to question. You can know how VeggieTales talks to people about genocide in Esther. Some of you know this. Some of you know how they deal with this. Okay? Now, they're not referred to in the movie as Jews, but just Mordecai's family. Just that his family is a problem. And instead of mass genocide, we will banish them to an island of perpetual tickling. The lord of this island will be the grim reaper with a feather. He will... That's how we made it easier to understand God. I'm not in charge of making VeggieTales. I'm not in charge of making any kids' productions. I can only imagine how hard it would be when you get to this part of Esther. How are we going to characterize that for five-year-olds? How are we going to tell an eight-year-old about this? Are we going to tell those teenagers at the U that are watching VeggieTales? I know there's some out there. Come on now. How are we going to tell them about that? It's hard, huh? It's hard to understand this. It's hard to understand Mordecai's actions. It's hard to understand Haman's attitude. It's hard to understand all that's happening here. And so we try to make it a little bit more easy to understand. Let's keep going on in our story. We're going to come back. Talk a little bit more about this. But Haman's plot of genocide. Look how Haman plots. Look how he manipulates King Xerxes over these next several verses. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, the Pur, that is the lot, was cast in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. Lots. This is not maybe language that we use. I just Googled it here for a picture. They got the Pur there. That's not it. Looks like a die, something similar to this. They're going to roll it and try to understand the leading of the gods, the leading of the divinities from up high. How should we go about this? We're plotting to kill. When should it happen? And so this Pur, this lot is cast in Haman's presence to figure out the day, the month that this event is going to take place. And it said it fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. And so you and I were not accustomed to looking at Hebrew calendars and thinking this through. And so I tried to grab a image that would be helpful here. Look directly at 12 o'clock or 12:30 there. That's Nisan. That's the first month for them. For us, that's like right now. That's springtime, end of March, early April. That's when they celebrate Passover. And so he casts Lot in Nisan to figure out when are we going to do this. And it ends up actually being almost a full calendar year, not until Adar. Which if you're Haman, he's probably like, come on now, come on seven. But it comes out to the 12th month. So there's almost a year between when Haman says this is going to happen to when the annihilation is actually going to happen. And so now we get to look at how this all plays out in the context of their community. What does this look like? Well, Haman's not number one. He's the number two guy, so he's got to go and talk to the number one. Haman said to King Xerxes, listen to how he frames this. It's very interesting. There's a certain people dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Think about that. Xerxes has areas all the way over to like present day Pakistan, down to Egypt, up to Turkey. He's got all this area covered. He says, amongst all those provinces and all those people dispersed in this area, there's a group that keeps to themselves. They keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people. They do not obey the king's laws. Look at how he paints this. Okay? It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, look at him presenting himself as the great hero. I'll take care of this. Let a decree be issued to destroy them. And I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury. Not only will I take care of this problem, I will fill your piggy bank, the piggy bank that got empty because your dad lost the war to take and ransack Greece. And I will refill your treasury. This is a win-win. I'll take care of the problem. I'll fill your piggy bank. And the whole time, Haman is just manipulating. Xerxes is just a puppet here. So the king took his signet ring from his finger, gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha of the Agagite. Now look how he's qualified later within the narrative. He's the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money. It's a strange phrase. It's not a phrase I'm going to spend time, even though I've read on it. There's probably going to be an interaction here about that whole financial bit. Not just like, hey, you can have it. Good for you. Way to go. The king said to Haman, do with the people as you please. Then on the 13th day of the first month, so we're in Nisan, right? This is just after the lots were cast. On the 13th day of the first month of Nisan, royal secretaries were summoned. Can you imagine these secretaries coming in? What's on the docket for today? What do you need me for? They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people. Remember, they're spread out. There's not a unified language. There's people, different tongues, different languages. Got all these different secretaries writing to these different provinces in different languages. All of Haman's orders to the king's satraps, they're kind of the head hogs out there, then down one level to the governors of the various provinces, and then even further down to the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Done. It's an edict of genocide. Just wipe out the Jews. Annihilate them. Given approval at the highest level from King Xerxes. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children. On a single day, the very day, they know the day that it's going to happen. The 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, almost a year later, 11 months later, to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they would be ready for that day. It's not just, hey, we as the leaders, we as Persians are going to go forth and take care of this. It's actually written into law that you are going to do this. Don't disobey the law. We are to kill and annihilate. If you're in our provinces and you're not a Jew, the expectation is you will be a part of obeying this law. That you will take up arms to eliminate any Jews in your province. Be ready on that day. The couriers went out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. And look at these responses. The king and Haman sat down to drink. But as you can imagine, seeing this posted, hearing this shared, the city of Susa was bewildered. I picture it like this. Two guys smoking, having a scotch, ever having put out this edict of genocide. And it says they're in having a drink. While outside the palace walls, the city is in an uproar. There's an edict of genocide to take place 11 months from now. And the whole city is turned upside down. It's chaos. The city is bewildered. So that's Esther chapter 3. I want to talk about two things. There's many things I could talk about. I want to talk about two things. Racism and persecution. I want to talk about racism and persecution. I sat under the teaching of a guy named Doug Magnuson, and he handed, as part of one of his class, he handed out a 30-page document, 30 pages, that look up the Bible's use of the word families, Gentiles, peoples, nations, ethne. What is God's heart? When we see family, when we see nations, which literally means Gentiles, when we see that in our Bibles, when we read that, what's associated with that? How are we to understand that? And I can't read you all 30 pages. I'll leave it up here if you want to page through at your leisure during the connection. What do we see in our Bibles when it talks about race and nations and Gentiles and peoples and families? What do we see? Let me give you a couple passages quickly here. Genesis 12, Lord said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's households to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I'll curse. And in you, all nations on the earth will be blessed through you. There's something about Abraham, his role, his call is not just to be a father of Israel, but a father of the nations. Romans captures this very clearly. I made you the father of the circumcised and of the uncircumcised. What's important in both of these is not circumcision or uncircumcision, but those who walk in faith, the faith that Abraham had before he was circumcised. So it's God's desire that in Abraham, all the nations would be blessed. And we see this, the gospel's preached beforehand, it says in Galatians 3, how? That in Abraham, all the nations will be blessed. There's something about the gospel, God's heart for the nations, God's heart for all people. Going back to another patriarch, okay? Going forward, I guess, in time. King David, therefore I will praise you, Lord, among the Gentiles, among the nations. Even though I am the king of Israel, I will praise you among the nations. I will sing the praises of your name. Fast forward to the New Testament. Mark 13:10. The gospel must first be preached to all the nations. Before the end can come, something has to happen. What? Nations, Gentiles, people that don't know. We got to preach to them. We got to preach to all people. This is not just a Jewish thing. It's not just a Western thing. It's not just an American. This is for all the nations of the earth. God cares about all of the earth. And we see this at the end of our Bibles, at the end of time, in Revelation 5. They sang a new song saying, you are worthy to take the scroll, to open its seals, because you were slain. And with your blood, Jesus, you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nations. For God loved the world that he gave his only son. There is no racism and classism within God's economy, within his kingdom. He wants all the nations to be blessed. All the nations, all the peoples, all the families to hear about his son Jesus, who was crucified, died, buried, raised, will return. But it's not just an out there thing. It's not just a missions thing. It's not just that if you can just get overseas, then you can do something about this. I want to ask us, what can we do now? What would God's word, what might his message be to us in response to this Bible call? I actually talked to some friends. I've had friends throughout my life. God is, I think there's been just a providence of, you know, I can go back to kindergarten, Naveen Sastry. Making a friend with Jake Jurassic, an adopted boy from South Korea. You know, moving forward in my timeline, I meet Neeraj Mehta, who's, I think the actual demographic thing was Asian Pacific Islander, Indian, you know. But he always made fun of the fact that I'm an Asian Pacific Islander. What does that even mean? Nidish Kandawe played football with him in high school. Going forward to the University of Minnesota, being surrounded with African Americans like Charles Coleman, and my locker buddy, Gary, what's your last name, Gary? Anyways, he's there. God has put these people in my life, and God has put people at Hope in my life. Africans, African-Americans, Asians. What does it look like to care, to love, to look out for, to bring forth justice here, now, in this place? When it comes to those who are experiencing life as the minority, what does it look like? What does it mean? I just approached some of them. Said, can you talk to me? Talk back at me. What have you experienced? What's been easy? What's been hard? And there's, as you can imagine, it's a mixed bag. Some have experienced very explicit, direct, painful. Others, they're left to wonder. Sometimes it's very indirect. It can feel like racism, but it's hard to call out. I just want to share some of their thoughts, their comments. If you're like me, you think guilt. That's not the intent here. The intent is we want to follow Jesus Christ. That's the intent. And if somebody were willing to show this as in a mirror, would we do something about it? Would we respond? And I'm asking myself that question. I don't have the, therefore this is what CORE is going to do. I'm asking myself the question, even as I preach this. Let me read a couple things from them. I think the main thing would be to seek out educating yourself on the realities of institutional racism and white privilege. Minnesota white folks, if I can be a little blunt, are generally very ignorant of these things. Institutional racism, that racism which is bound up in the way we do things, the habits that have gotten embodied within organizations, within politics, within business and governance and economy, those things that are present. Are we blind to those? Do we miss those? Do you understand that there's this thing defined as white privilege? How does that play out? We might be thinking, well, I don't know, I don't notice it. Well, there you go. Guess it's working just fine for you. Again, not guilt. This is something that those in our church and those in our city experience. One thing I've noticed is how stereotypes put people off from getting to know someone from a different race or ethnic background here in the States. This person had lived in a couple different areas. Is that something that just keeps you from even approaching the other? I can remember doing a project in seminary that dealt with this issue, and I just listed probably 25 different ways that I thought, in a very small, off-the-cuff, wouldn't require a lot, ways that bridges could be made across race relations. At that time, I was living in the city, and I just said, well, for example, somebody's walking by, and I'm working in my yard. Just say hi. And my African-American professor commented on that. He just, that's great. He was just excited that I, as a white guy, would just say hi to somebody of a different race. He just like, that's fantastic. That didn't happen when I was growing up. And that, for me, that was one of those Damascus Road scales from my eyes. I can't even believe that. That people wouldn't even say hi to you. And that's what he experienced. That was his. So he's looking at me going, that's incredible. I've experienced racism in the sense that I do very well in school, and I have come across quite a number of people who were shocked that I could do so well. They should understand that generally a minority have to work twice as hard as others to be successful. Others of you are minorities for other reasons, not associated with race, and you're feeling that same experience of having to work doubly hard just to be acknowledged on the same plane and level. I don't have the answer. I don't have the fix. I just know it's not over. It's not done. The work's still going on. And God's heart is for justice, for grace, for relationship, for love, for blessing. Persecution. John 16:33. Look at this promise. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble. In this world, you will have trouble. Take heart, I have overcome the world. From John 15. If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Remember what I told you? A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also. They will treat you this way because of me, because of my name. For they do not know the one who sent me. You might not experience this, but there are Christians that do. Just looking at a poster in my office of the 1040 window, looking at kind of that right along the equator, restricted nations, hostile nations, to claim the name of Christ, to believe in Him. look at these words that were spoken of Haman and consider that there are Christians that experience these kind of edicts today. There is a certain people dispersed amongst the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. These Christians, they keep to themselves. They separate themselves. Their customs are different from those of all the other people. They do not obey our laws. It is not in our best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases, let a decree be issued to destroy them. Brothers and sisters of Christ that are ours around the world are suffering under an edict like that. It's real. You and I, we experience this in different ways, varied ways. Even around this room, probably. So how do we do this? How do we respond to this? I want to give us a little instruction, a little gospel application as we talk about the story of Mordecai, the Jews, the edict of genocide, as we think through and trace this forward through racism. How are we to respond? This is hard. We're talking about this in our New Testament class, this idea of being in the world, but not of the world. It would be so easy, wouldn't it, if we could just separate ourselves, just lock the front door, keep to ourselves, separate ourselves fully from the world, the challenges, some of the struggles when they bring their issues against the teaching of the Bible and trying to understand, when I see an equal sign coming through my Facebook feed, how should I respond to that? Pastor, just tell me what to do. Should I defriend them? Should I unlike their comment? If I can, I'll put it in little asterisks. Does that help? Should I create a different meme of a cross? What should I do? How should I respond? Should I just separate myself from them? That's one response. Another response would be to merge together with them, to become syncretistic, where all of a sudden it's very hard to see your Christian beliefs separating yourself from the world at all. And this is the struggle, this in but not of, in the world but not of the world. In the world, making a difference, honoring God by helping as many people as possible become fully devoted followers of Christ. We want to be in the world, not just in the bubble, with Christians, in the world. And yet somehow, so that we're bringing forth a seasoning like salt, not being of the world, not having them impact us in a way that causes detriment to our faith in Jesus Christ, but us seasoning with love, grace, truth, that we might bless. And so how has God made this easier to understand? It's hard sometimes looking at Mordecai just saying, well, sometimes he goes left, sometimes he goes right. It's hard. Jesus gives us the example. In, not of. In, not of. Two words. Incarnation, crucifixion. Jesus comes, God made flesh. He's a man. He's in the world. He's experiencing temptation, bodily struggle, weariness, people coming against him in his teaching. He's there healing, forgiving of sin, and teachers are coming against him saying, you can't do that. He's in the world, engaged in the world, doing life with the people, hanging out with sinners. And yet there was a time and a place where him being him wouldn't be acceptable anymore to the people. Where him saying, I'm in but not of, would result in crucifixion. There is a hill to die on. Jesus made that decision. Golgotha is the hill to die on. Calvary, I'm going to die there for the sin of the people. That's the hill I'm going to die on. Just come down off the cross, Jesus. We'll make it all. No, no, no. There's a hill to die on. We're not going to be of the world. Just make sure we're dying on the right hills. In, but not of. See it in his incarnation. Believe it in his crucifixion. And he says, I will not leave you alone. I'll give you a helper, Holy Spirit. There is no law anymore that says always go right or always go left. Rather, you have a helper, a counselor, the Holy Spirit to help you in the moment. Engaging the issues, the people, neighbors, friends, family. Incarnation, crucifixion. All the crazy stuff, all the big stuff, all that teaching and background and Old Testament stuff, leave with incarnation, crucifixion, in, but not of. I want to invite the worship team forward. We have a chance to worship God now through song, through communion. And we get to celebrate crucifixion this morning. For those of you that are new to Hope, you don't have to be a member of Hope to take part in communion. You don't have to be a member here or anywhere. We just ask that you're a follower of Christ. Because as you come forward and you take the bread and you take the cup, you are proclaiming something. You're proclaiming Jesus' death. On the night he was betrayed, Jesus took some bread, he broke it, and he said, "This is my body given for you." And he was foretelling what was going to happen on the cross. In the same way, he took the drink after supper. Said, "This is the new covenant of my blood. Do this as you meet together. Do this as often as you meet together in remembrance of me." And so we get to remember his death, remember his crucifixion. Remember his example of being in but not of incarnation and crucifixion.